So it's not as formal, and we can make it a bit casual, and you can get as much as you can out of it. Okay, so we're going to be looking at James chapter 4. Now, about a month ago, you probably looked at James chapter 3, and what are some of the things you got out of James chapter 3? What was James speaking on?
The tongue,
yes? That's exactly right. And so we looked at the tongue, and who was he actually addressing when he was speaking of the tongue? Who was he speaking to? The clue is in verse 1 of chapter 3. Who was he speaking to about the tongue? The ecclesia, yeah, and particularly in the ecclesia? The teachers, yeah, that's exactly right. Okay, and when we come to the end of chapter 3, which we're going to look at, we find there in verses 15 to 18, he's talking about the wisdom from above, and he compares it to the wisdom below. And then he concludes in verse 18, and he says, "And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace." So you need to keep that in your minds. Okay, now we come to chapter 4. Now, before we look into chapter 4, I want to ask you a question. Now, I've been speaking to James McCann a fair bit about this, and he said it'd be a good idea to open with this question in verse 4. Now, have a read of verse 4, James chapter 4 and verse 4. It says, "Ye adulterers and adulteresses, know ye not that the friendship of the world is enmity with God? Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is the enemy of God." Now, it's a common verse, you've probably heard it before. What do you actually think it means? I'm asking for comments. What do you think it's talking about? Des can't answer this because I've already discussed it with him. The reason I'm asking this question is because I think it's directly related, and we're going to see this throughout the whole chapter of James, chapter 4. We're going to see this theme come out. What do you think it's saying? Some ideas. Come on. Okay, you can't have friendship with the world.
Any friend of the world is not a friend of God.
Okay, so does everyone think that's what it's saying? You can't have friendships in the world. Everyone agree with that? Nathan, you can't say no. Okay, no. I'm going to say that's not what it's saying. All right? So Johnny has said friendships with the world. I'm saying that is not what it's actually saying. And we're going to see that from the context, okay? I'm not saying that you should be having friends in the world, because I think there's other places in Scripture that supports that idea. But in terms of James chapter 4 and verse 4, I don't believe it's saying that, and we're going to see why. Okay, so let's read. We'll start from Mr. Desmond. We'll start with verse 1 of chapter 4. And I'll just read one verse each as we read around.
"From whence come war and fighting among you? Come they not hence, even of your lust, the war in your members?
Ye lust and have not, ye kill and desire to have, and cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not, because ye ask not.
Ye ask and receive not, because ye ask amiss, that ye may consume it upon your lusts."
Okay. Stay there. So verses 1 to 3. Okay, so what's the background? What have we already talked about? What's the background? What's James chapter 3 about? The tongue, isn't it? And what have we just seen? What did I say about the last few verses there? What is it comparing? James chapter 3, verse 15 to 18. What have you got?
Wisdom.
You've got the wisdom of what?
Above.
You've got the wisdom of above, and you've got the wisdom from below. And it concludes there, and it says, "And the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace." And so as we come to verses 1 to 3, and if you think about it, what was James chapter 3 about? It was about the tongues. Who was it directed at? It was directed at the elders. And so he says, then he goes and... Yeah, Tom?
Can you move
your
mic closer?
Mic closer, sorry. I'm sorry. Is that close? Closer? Okay. A bit far away. Okay, so keep that in mind. You've got James chapter 3. He's speaking directly to the elders. He's saying, control your tongues. And then we're comparing this earthly wisdom to this heavenly wisdom. And then he goes in verse 18, he talks about the peace of righteousness. And then bang, straight into verses 1 to 3 of chapter 4. What have we got? What is it that we're reading of? We've got wars. Who is it with? Who is it speaking to now?
Amongst yourselves.
Yeah, amongst yourselves. It's amongst the ecclesia. So not only was the problem with the elders, but we read straight in, just after talking about peace, we're straight from whence come wars and fightings among you? Okay, so we've got the exact same problem in the ecclesia as was with the elders. And so if we look at a couple of the words there, we've got wars there, and what it actually means warfare, and it can mean either literally or figuratively, and it comes from either verbal controversy, and it can also mean to open warfare. Okay, so you've got it with the tongues, or it can mean open warfare. You've got fightings in there. See in verse 1, I think it's too close now, is it? Verse 1, you've got fightings, which means a battle, and it's generally used in other circumstances, talking of verbal disputes. So we can see that it's being linked back to James 3 with the tongue. And then we've also got lustings in there, don't we? And then you see in verse 2 there, it says, "Ye lust and have not, ye kill." Now that word "kill" literally means to kill. It literally means to murder, right? And this is happening within the ecclesia. And then again, you've got fights and wars in verse 2 there. And so what is it? It's the complete opposite that we're seeing in the ecclesia, isn't it? It's the complete opposite to what we're seeing in James chapter 3. Now, I want you to look at verse 1. Where is all of this coming from? You've got all these fightings and disputes. Where is all this coming from in verse 1?
Lusts.
The lusts. Okay, the word lust there, it means pleasures. And it's actually referring to worldly pleasures. And what was it? What was it doing? What was the lust doing? Yeah, it's warring. Where is it warring?
Within themselves.
So you've got these worldly pleasures that are warring within themselves. We'll just wait for Philly, can I? Okay, so you've got these worldly pleasures, which in verse 1, the lusts, and where are they warring? They're warring within their members. Now, where else can you think of? Can you think of another verse somewhere else that talks about a similar concept to this? Yes, Paul. Exactly, in Romans 7 and verse 23. Turn over there. And this is a good one to write down. Romans 7 and verse 23. If our next reader wants to, Jim, if you want to read on with that.
"But I see another law in my members, warring against the law of my mind, and bringing me into captivity to the law of sin, which is in my members."
Okay, and he goes on and he says, "O wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from this body of death? I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. So then, with the mind I myself serve the law of God, but with the flesh the law of sin." So what's the battle going on here? What is the battle? The battle with sin. So you've got two things in here. What's fighting against each other?
Flesh,
yeah, mind and spirit. So the flesh and the spirit, right? So you've got Paul. He's got this body of flesh, but he's trying to combat it. He's trying to fight that with the mind of the spirit. Now, if we turn back to James chapter 4, what do we find that is different? I want you guys thinking about it. What do you find that's different? What is not told in verse 1? So think about the two things that you've got in Romans.
There's no spirit.
There's no spirit. That's exactly right. So you've got this battle that Paul is talking about. You've got this battle between the spirit and the flesh. But then when you come across to James, the brothers and sisters in the ecclesia, all they've got is this warring of the flesh. All they're doing is serving the flesh. And so you can see the difference there. There's no mention of the spirit in James. And if you read on, like, you read on in verse 2, it says, ye lust and ye have not. Ye kill, you even go to the extent of murdering your brothers and sisters. And ye desire to have, but ye cannot obtain. Ye fight and war, yet ye have not. Okay, so there's these frustrated desires. You've got this desire of the flesh, but it can't obtain. It's envying what their brothers and sisters have, but they can't obtain it. And it says there, it then goes on in verse 3, they even went to the extent that they were praying about it. You see there in verse 3, it says, ye ask and receive not. So they were actually asking God that that their desires might be fulfilled. You see in the end of verse 3, why were they asking? What were they asking of God? It's at the end of verse 3. That they might consume it upon their lusts. Okay, so you can see that they're even asking God that they might fulfill their lusts. Now, in verse 3, that word amiss, does anyone have any idea what the word amiss there means? Blinded? It's a good guess. Good guess. The word amiss there means diseased. Okay, so what it's saying is that their prayers, they were asking God, but their prayers were diseased. It had this infectious disease. Because why? Because their prayers, they were purely for what their wants were. It was purely for their desires. It wasn't in accordance with God's will. Like, what do we know? And it's in the notes there. What do we know about prayer? What should we be asking for in prayer? And the clue's in, it's in Luke 22 and verse 42. It's in your notes there. Luke 22 and verse 42. Turn it up and you tell me. Their prayers are diseased. Why? Because they are praying for their own lusts and desires. What's the problem with that? What should they have been praying for? Yeah, exactly right. For God's will to be done. Who's got Luke 22 and verse 42? Juice, do you want to read it out?
No. Saying, Father, if thou be willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, my will be done.
Okay, so there's Christ, the perfect example. And what is he saying? In the most excruciating circumstances, he's saying, not my will, but thine be done. But then when we come back to James, we've got these people that they're diseased in their prayer. And they're praying for their own desires. So you can see how mixed up it is, isn't it? And that was the circumstances in which we find the brothers and sisters in the ecclesia that James is writing to. Now, thinking about this, where else have we seen this kind of this concept in James? It's in James. What should they have been in their prayers? What should they have been? I'll give you a clue. It's in James 1. As we go through James 4, we're going to have all these references back to James of what he's previously spoken about. So what weren't they in their way of thinking? If you've got, they're meant to be, what are they meant to be doing? They're meant to be, living a godly life, but they're fulfilling their own, they're trying to fulfill their own desires. So where in James 1 are we told about this? There's two things going on in their minds. Verse 8. James got it. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Okay, so they're asking God. They're asking God for things that they want. They're not singular in mind. They're double-minded. They've got these different intentions of what they want. And so you see there in verse 3, he says, ye ask, but because they were asking for their own desires, because they're double-minded, they received not. So does that make sense? Is everyone kind of following? Okay, so what are we seeing in the brothers and sisters here? What is this that we're seeing? Now, I've already given you a hint. The hint is in James chapter 3. What is this behaviour? What is this behaviour that they're actually showing? Yes, earthly. This is earthly wisdom that they're actually showing. Now, where would you expect to find this kind of wisdom? Or who would you expect to find this wisdom in? Yes, the world. Right? So is it starting to make sense? So now when we come to verse 4, right, let's read out verse 4. Who's the next reader, Tom?
Adulterers and adulteresses. Now you know that the friendship of the world is enmity with God. Whosoever therefore will be a friend of the world is an enemy of God.
Okay, so now I want you to explain that verse to me. I asked the question at the start, and the typical answer that comes out is that you can't have friends with the world. But with the context that we've just looked at, and now when we read that verse, what's the connection?
Acting like the world.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Who said that what they were showing was earthly wisdom? Right, from James chapter 3. What they were showing in their character was earthly wisdom. And as Jim has just pointed out, when you come to verse 4, this is the kind of behaviour that you expect to see in the world. Does that make sense? Can everyone see the connection there? And so if you're showing that behaviour, essentially you are a friend of the world. And if you're a friend of the world, as it says in the at the end there, it actually makes you an enemy of God. Now, most translations actually omit the word adulterers, and it leaves the word that Tom stumbled on, which is a bit of a tongue twister, adulteresses. So it should actually read ye adulteresses. Now, where is it that you get such a term? Well, what are the circumstances in that you'd get adulteresses? Does that make sense? Someone who's unfaithful? Yes, the bride. So both are right. So it's in a marriage context, isn't it? And you would get an adulteress is when someone that has been unfaithful in their vows. Okay, and now let's apply this to us. How does it apply to us? Or how does it apply to the context of James as well? Who is he speaking to? The Ecclesia. Okay, now let's piece it together. Yeah, you just jumped to the end. You just jumped to the end. That's exactly right. So Tom just said, what did you say?
It's like you're cheating on God.
Yeah, it's like you're cheating on God. That's right. So he did jump to the end. So from Ephesians 5, we get the connection that the Ecclesia is the bride of Christ. Exactly. And so he's saying here, he's speaking to the brothers and sisters in James, and he's saying, ye adulteresses. So they were meant to be displaying the wisdom of God, but what had they done? They're actually displaying the wisdom of the earth, earthly wisdom. And he's saying, you've been unfaithful to me, ye adulteresses. They were showing the behaviour of the world and not of God. So does that all make sense? We kind of all keeping up with what it's meaning. And so as we move on to verse 5. And who's our next? Yeah, Liz? Okay, so verse 5, the spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy, or the meaning of that word is ill will. Now, had many conversations with Mr. McCann about this verse, because there's a couple of different ways that this way can be interpreted. Now, the way that I'm going to run with it is this. It says there that, do you think that the scripture saith in vain, the spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy. Now that word envy means ill will. Right? So the spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to ill will. Now whose spirit is in us? God's spirit. That's right. That's what they were meant to have in them, wasn't it? It was meant to be God's spirit that was in them. And so if we read it that way, do you think that the scripture saith in vain, the spirit that dwelleth in us, that's God's spirit that dwelleth in us, lusteth to envy? And what's the answer? Sorry? Yes or no? Does God's spirit lusteth to envy? Does it lusteth toward ill will? Well, the answer is no, isn't it? But what was happening? Exactly right. People were lusting to ill will. And so can you see how that verse fits then within the context of what we've been talking about? Yes? No? Does that make sense? Okay, so, and so as a result of this, this spirit that they were actually displaying, they were causing strife and division within the ecclesia, right? And if we look back at James 3 and verse 16, who's our next reader? Do you want to read James 3 and verse 16? Okay, so it's speaking about the wisdom that descends not from above, and it says, for where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. So where were we seeing this? Where was this happening? In the ecclesia. So what were they displaying? They were displaying the wisdom that descends from the earth. Now, if they were displaying the Spirit of God, what would we see? Well, exactly right. The opposite. Let's turn over to Philippians 2 and verses 1 to 5. So we're thinking about what they've been displaying. They've been displaying the wisdom of man. It's caused strife and divisions. They've been arguing, and they've been arguing to fulfill their own lusts. And it says they have been showing the character of someone that's in the world. So if they were displaying the Spirit of God, what would we have seen? So let's have a look at Philippians. Who's their next readers? Juice, do you want to read that?
If there be therefore any consolation in Christ, if any comfort of love, if any fellowship of the Spirit, if any doubt and mercies, fill ye my joy, if ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind.
Let nothing be done through strife or vain glory, but in reverence of man, let each esteem other better than themselves.
Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others.
Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus.
Remain in the form of God, so that not my glory be in you.
Okay, so if they were displaying those where are those characteristics from? Well, they're from the Spirit of God, aren't they? So if they were displaying those characteristics, what would we have seen? As Tom said before, the complete opposite. We probably wouldn't even have this letter of James chapter 4. And so, okay, so he goes on now, and in verse 6, and we'll just read verse 6 there, the next one. Who's their next reader?
That he giveth more grace, wherefore he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble.
Okay, so what do you think he's saying there? There's the contrasting word there. He says, but. So what is the context in verse 5 that we've been looking at, in verses 4 and 5? What do you think he's now saying? Sorry? Yes. Yeah, essentially he is. Yes, he's saying, but. So, even though you've been committing adultery to me, even though you've been unfaithful, you've been showing this wisdom of the earth, he says, but he giveth more grace. Wherefore, he saith, God resisteth the proud, but giveth grace unto the humble. So, he's addressing two types of people here. He's addressing who? He's addressing, it's in the end there, there's two types of people. The proud and the humble, that's exactly right. So the proud, we've already seen in the Ecclesia, they were proud. They were wanting to fulfill their own desires. And he's saying there, but he gives grace unto the humble. So what he's saying is that if you are a proud person and that you're going to remain a proud person, then God is going to resist you. God is not going to force you to love him. Does that make sense? So God is not going to force you to love him. But if you've been committing adultery, but then you realize you've been doing wrong, you've been doing the wrong thing, and then you humble yourself, then he says that he's going to give you grace. He'll give grace unto the humble. Isaiah 57 and verse 15, it's a good one to write down. It says there, I dwell in the high and holy place with him also that is of a contrite and humble spirit. Okay, so if we move on then into verses 7 to 10 and our next readers. Okay, so verses 7 to 10 are really about how we can return to God. So if we've been committing adultery with God, if we've been going off following our own desires, then verses 7 to 10 is how we can actually return to God. And the first thing in doing so, he says that we need to submit ourselves to him. So what does that actually involve, submitting yourself to God? What is that? If you submit yourself to someone, what does that mean? Yes, you accept your authority and... Sorry? Yeah, their authority. So what position does that then put you in? Yeah, below them. Exactly right. So if you think about us and then if you think about God, what are you doing? You're acknowledging your position before God, aren't you? You're submitting yourself to him. So what are you realizing about your own nature? You're weak? How are you weak? Yeah, exactly right. So you're sinful. You're sinful. You're acknowledging your human nature. And so therefore, he says that if you want to come back to God, you need to submit yourself before him. You need to get rid of the pride that might be in your nature. You need to submit yourself to God. And he goes on and he says, you need to resist the devil and he will flee from you. And so if you think about our fight with sin, right, if you think about each time you resist the devil or your temptations within you, the easier it is next time. But what happens if you give in to them? It becomes easier to give in to them next time. So you need to resist the devil and he will flee from you. And then in verse 8, he says, what do you need to do? You need to draw nigh to God. And then what will happen? If you draw nigh to God, what will happen? He will draw nigh to you. So you need to make that first step. Right? You need to draw nigh to God. But as soon as you draw nigh to him, God is going to come and meet you more than halfway. And let's turn up 2 Corinthians. This is a great cross-reference. 2 Corinthians 15 and verses 1 to 4. Sorry? Sorry? Maybe it's 1 Corinthians. Is it 1 Corinthians or he's talking to... Oh, no, I've got the wrong cross-reference. It's 2 Chronicles. Sorry, it is 2 Chronicles. I was just making sure. Well, don't be awkward. 2 Chronicles, okay, and pizzas are nearly there and I'm starving. Yeah, chapter 15, 2 Chronicles 15 in verses 1 to 4. Okay, who's our next readers? Timon or Dan or Nathan? You got it? second.
God came upon as a way of the son of Obed. Do you want me to read the whole lot?
If you like, if you want to be greedy.
All right. And he went out to meet Asa and said to him, "Hear me, Asa, all Judah and Benjamin. Yahweh is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. For a long time Israel was without the true God and without teaching priests and without law. But when their distress had turned to Yahweh, the God of Israel, and sought him, he was found by them."
Okay, fantastic. So can you see how those exact same principles are being brought out there? So as soon as you turn back to God, he will be with you. Now, if you think about Israel, what had Israel been doing? Clues in verse 4. What had Israel been doing? Clues in verse 4. They'd been committing adultery. But what does it say? They turned back to God, and what did God do? He turned back to them. Exactly right. So doesn't that encourage you? Like, doesn't that make you feel really encouraged by the character of God? Well, it does for me. It does for me. So you can say yes. It's meant to be interactive class. All right, so we're going to break for dinner, but I just want to ask you a question that you can think about over dinner. And so in verse 8 it says, "Draw nigh to God and he will draw nigh to you," which we've just discussed. And he says, "Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded." Now the question's in the notes. Why does he address these two types of people? All right, and that's the why does he address these two types of people, and what is it meaning?
As in sinners and double-minded.
Okay, so what was the question we left off with for supper? No, before dinner, not supper, before dinner. What was the question? What verse are we in? Verse 8. Okay, and what's the question we had in verse 8? That's right. So what is it? Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. So there's two groups of people there. What is he actually referring to? It's in the notes, if you're up to chapter 4. There's two classes of people there. So what is the hands? Let's work it out. The hands? Yes, sinners, yes, they're... Compare it to the mind. So if you compare the hands to the mind, so that the hands are external to the body. Okay, so he's saying that he's talking about actions now. So the hands is referring to people that were actually out there sinning. Okay, they were actually physically doing the wrong thing. You could see their actions; they were wrong. And then who's the other group of people? You got those people that were thinking the wrong things. They were double-minded. So they might have, you know, they may have been coming along to the meeting and so on, but they were double-minded in the way they were thinking. And so he covers both types of people. He covers those that are actually out there sinning and also those that are double-minded. Okay, and he says you need to cleanse your hands, you sinners, and you need to purify your hearts. You need to purify your way of thinking, you double-minded. And so when we come to verse 9, he gives us the answer of how we're actually going to do this. Okay, so he gives us the answer of how we're going to cleanse your hands, you sinners, and how we're going to purify our hearts, you double-minded. So where were we up to in the reading? And we'll read verses 9 and 10. Whoever was next... Okay, so what is this? Think about it's quite a weird couple of verses, but what actually are they? What are they characteristics of? Think about what we've been talking in verses 6 and 7. And there's the clue in verse 10 there. I mean, what are these kind of characteristics Exactly. Jews, a humble person. Okay, so you're not going to get these kind of characteristics in a proud person, are you? Now that word in verse 9 that says the word afflicted there, it means wretched. And in Romans 7 verse 24, which is a good verse to write in there, it says, "O wretched man that I am." So he's talking about the nature that we all possess. And so if we're to draw nigh to God in verse 8, we first have to acknowledge our unrighteousness. Okay, we have to acknowledge that we're sinners. And he then goes on to talk about, he says, "Let your laughter be turned to mourning." And he's talking about the laughter that's referred to in Ecclesiastes 7 verse 6. That's another one. He says, "The laughter is of a fool." Okay, so he's referring to the behaviour of that in the world. So he's saying the laughter of the fools, the laughter of those that are out in the world, which is what they were showing in their behaviour within the ecclesia. And he goes on, he says, "Your joy, let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to heaviness." Now the heaviness here, it means downcast, a downcast look of sorrow. Now, if we think about this kind of attitude, where have we seen this attitude before? Where's a good example of a person that was showing these characteristics? I think it's in the notes as well. New Testament. To give you a hint. A person that was showing these characteristics of humbleness. Oh, yeah. That's one that I wasn't thinking of. Luke 18, verse 13, the publican. What was the publican? Perfect example. He couldn't even lift his eyes. He recognised the nature that he was. And who was in contrast to that?
Sinner.
Yeah? The Pharisee. And what was it about that? What was the characteristic that the Pharisee was showing? Pride. That's right. So you can see how it's all kind of fitting together. And so if we reflect, if we think about what we've been looking at, what is the attitude of those in the ecclesia? It was of pride, wasn't it? They weren't showing these humble characteristics that they were meant to be showing. So can you see how it all pieces together? That's one thing that I was hoping that you could see, is that how it all pieces together. We've started off in verse 1. And we've worked our way through to verse 10, and we've seen how it all actually fits. When we come now to verses 11 to 16, what we're going to show is that he's been talking about how you've got to humble yourself, how you actually do it, how you cleanse your heart, what it means to be humble. And what he's now going to put forward to us is a test, a little test that we can use to actually test if we are actually humble. Does that make sense? So if you think you're humble, well, he's going to put forward two tests to see whether you're actually humble or not. And so we'll read, let's read verses 11 to, we'll just read verses 11 to 12. This is the first test. Okay, so what are the two things that it mentions there in verses 11 and 12? There's two aspects that he focuses on. What's the first one? Yes, speaking evil. And then what's the other one? Judging. So speaking evil of one another and judging your brother. Now, the word speaking evil there, it means to slander. Now, I want you to really apply this to ourselves now. Like, I think we can all relate to this. What is it about us, and why is it that we actually speak evil or we slander one another? Now, using the terminology of James, don't deceive yourselves, for we all speak evil of one another. And why is it that we do?
Make ourselves better.
Yes, exactly right. Make ourselves better. It makes you. It's comforting to. Well, It makes you feel better by bringing someone else down. That's right. Now, in Romans, let's turn up Romans. If someone can turn up, the next reader can turn up Romans 1 verse 30, and that's another good one to write down. Romans 1 and verse 30. Right, who's got that? Okay, so the same word there is, sorry, I should have turned up, is backbiters. And if you have a look at the context, it's actually referring to the flesh. So this backbiting or this slandering is actually a part of the flesh, which explains why we've actually got a natural tendency towards it, because we are flesh. So we've got this natural tendency towards bringing others down. And as we saw, it makes us feel better when we do. And so again, if we think back to the characteristics that we should be showing, it's humility, which meant, what was it in Philippians 2? That's right, putting others first, esteeming each other better than ourselves. Not bringing them down, but we should be esteeming each other better than ourselves. And so if we have this, we have the Spirit of God. It's the Spirit of God that is esteeming others better than ourselves, whereas the spirit of man is bringing others down. So that's what it's talking about. So the next question then we have to ask is, what is the judging we are talking about? Is it okay to judge someone?
Yes.
Okay, but here it's saying, if I get out of Romans and come back to James, here it's saying, he that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. So it's in a negative context. So what is that meaning? You're saying it's okay to judge, or how do you support that? And it's in the notes. If you have a look at the notes, how do you support that it's okay to judge? Yeah. Okay. In the notes, sorry, I haven't got it actually in my notes, but in the notes there's a verse that, who's filled out the, has anyone actually looked up the verses? There's one that talks about their fruits, by their fruits they shall know them. Has anyone got the, where's the notes?
Is it Matthew 7:15?
Could be Matthew 7. So it's talking about, by their fruits they shall know them. So what does that mean? It was talking about, and grievous wolves shall enter in, and you shall know them by their fruits.
Their actions,
that's right. So you had to make a judgment on their actions. So we know that, and there's other verses that actually support that. So therefore, what Jake is saying is right. It is okay to judge if we're judging their actions. So what is this judgment, do you think this judgment is actually talking about? Okay, think of Matthew 7 and verses 1 to 5. What was it actually talking about? What's Matthew 7 verses 1 to 5?
How you judge is how you're going to be judged.
And what also? What does he do? He picks out the something in his brother's eye and misses the what in his own eye. That's right. And so what this judgment is actually talking about is a judgment of motives. It's a fault-finding judgment, and they're condemning the person's motives. Now, what's wrong with that? Exactly right. You don't know their motives. So, yes, on one hand, you can judge their actions because you can see it, but you don't actually know what their motives might be behind that, so you can't judge their motives. Does that make sense? Everyone follow with that? Nod your head if you think you follow with that. Okay. Now the next part, we see, I'm trying to break this verse down. I'm trying to break it into the different elements. The next part is, what law are we talking about? If we see there, it says, so he that speaketh evil is of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. Where else have we referred to this law? Now, this isn't, I still struggle with this, with thinking about this, so hopefully I'll try and make it very clear. Where else have we seen in James? It's in James. James 2, yes, James 2 and verse 8. What does it say? Yes, exactly. So if you love your neighbour as the commandment is to love thy neighbour as thyself. Where else in James have we talks about a law? James 1 verse 25, which means, which reads, sorry. Okay, so let's try and break this down as simply as we can. So we're talking about a law here. As Jake said, one of the aspects of this law is to love thy neighbour as thyself. The other mention of it is the law of liberty. Now, what is the law of liberty? Well, the law of liberty, I'm going to explain it, is that it's pretty much everything, it encompasses everything that God is about. Okay, so it talks about his whole redemption, the work of Christ. It's talking about all of that, and it is all summed up in the two commandments, which are, what are the two greatest commandments? Love the Lord thy God and love thy neighbour as thyself. So it's all encompassing, the law of liberty. It has freed us from sin and death through Christ. And it's summed up with love the Lord thy God and love thy neighbour as thyself. So is everyone still following? Everyone's still right? So how were they speaking evil of the law? We're going into the next, we're trying to break it down. How were they speaking evil of the law? It says, speak not evil of one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law. So how were they speaking evil of the law? Exactly right. Exactly right. They weren't loving their neighbour as themselves. So, in a sense, what they're saying, like if I'm going and speaking evil to all of you, what am I saying? I'm effectively saying that I don't have to keep that law. I'm going against what the law is saying. And what it's saying is that God, in creating that law, has created it falsely. So if I'm not keeping it, I'm going against it. I'm saying, well, it's not worthy of keeping. So does that make sense? Yeah, exactly. Okay, now the next part. This is the tricky part. How were they judging the law? Think about what the law of liberty was meaning. Think of it as an all-encompassing. It's about God's redemption for us, forgiveness of sins through Christ. How were they judging the law? Any ideas? Okay, so they were, what were they meant to do? Think back to James 1. What are the two men? The two men that look in the mirror. What was he trying to show? The two men that look in the mirror, what was... One person was something and the other person was... Yes. One was a doer and one was a hearer. And what were they a doer of? Or what are we meant to be a doer of? The law. We're meant to be a doer of the law. But instead, what was happening? They were judging one another, weren't they? So they were meant to be doing the law, but instead of doing the law, they were actually judging one another. Now, if they're judging people, they're judging motives, they're fault-finding, right? They're doing all these judgments. well, what happens if God has actually forgiven that person for what they've done? And yet this person is still actually judging them. What do they become? They become a judge of the law, don't they? So they apply the law of, say, of forgiveness when they want to. So what they're actually doing, in effect, they're actually... who has set up the law?
God.
So if God's standing there, they're actually jumping in front of God and they're saying, well, no, I'm going to judge the law. I'm going to hold these grudges. I'm going to judge these people's motives for what they've done. And yet God, who is actually the lawmaker, may have actually forgiven them. And we don't know that. We don't know. So how can we actually judge? I mean, we, as Jake said before, we can't actually even perceive what people might be thinking. And so you can see, hopefully does that make sense? Can you see how dangerous that way of thinking can be? If you're judging the motives of your brother, you actually may be judging the law. And you actually may be judging someone for what they've done that Christ, that God has actually forgiven. Does that make sense? It's pretty... Which is, yeah, exactly right.
Are you going to love your neighbour or are you
going to
judge your neighbour?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly right. And you can see that in verse, at the end of verse 11. So if you have a look at verse 11, if you've become a judge of the law, then what aren't you?
A doer.
You're not a doer. And what had they been commanded to do? They'd been, back in James chapter 1, they'd been commanded to be a doer of the law. And so it's, if you think about the characteristic that they're then showing, it's one of pride, isn't it? I mean, instead of loving their neighbour, they're actually thinking that they're better than them. They've actually forgotten who they are. Who actually are they? Romans 3 verse 23, who are they? What's Romans 3 verse 23 about? We've all sinned. Exactly right. So they're actually forgetting who they are. They're actually like the man in the mirror who looks at the mirror and then he walks away. He forgets who he is. He deceives himself and actually thinks he's better than what he is. And he's gone and established himself as God, which is essentially what they're doing. They're actually going and setting themselves... They're usurping God's authority. And instead of doing the law, they're then becoming a judge of the law. And so in verse 12, James says, I mean, there is only one lawgiver who is able to destroy and to save and destroy. I mean, can you save and destroy? If I go and say all these judgments against you, at the end of the day, what impact can they actually have on you? I mean, what impact can I have on you? None. And so if someone wants to turn up Matthew 10 and verse 28, well, we're talking about that. So I can have no impact on you at all, can I? And so if someone reads out Matthew 10 and verse 28, whoever's got it, go read. That's right. So there's only one lawmaker that can actually have any impact, and that's the one that we have to fear. All right. So he says there in verse 12, well, if you're not the lawgiver, well, then who are you that actually judges one another? So like Phil said, the emphasis there is actually on doing the law, loving thy neighbour as thyself, acknowledging who you are. You're not some proud person, acknowledging from that where you've come from and who you are. You're not actually better than your brother or sister. You're like them. You're all have sinned. Okay, so we've got 5 minutes. And so that's the first example of how you can test your humility. How is your interaction with your brothers and sisters in the ecclesia?
Now, our next one is about what our planning is in our lives. And so if we just read verses 13 to 16, our next readers. Leave that. Okay, so what do we read there? What do we read? What's the story? Don't jump to the conclusion. What's the story? It's about someone that's making plans, isn't it? And if you read there in verse 13, I'm going to read it to you. It says, "Go to now, ye that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year, and buy, and sell, and get gain." Now, it's very specific, isn't it? What's specific about it? Yes, the time. So he said. The time? What else? Yes, they think it's a matter of fact. Where are they going? They're going to a city. They've got a place planned out. What are they going to do? They're going to buy and sell. And what's the purpose of it? The gain. That's right. Now, what don't you see in that verse? Yes. Yes. Both of them. Both of them. Right? So can you see the point that he's making? And so what kind of character is this? What kind of person would have this way of thinking? Proud person. So can you see how it's all flowing on? So you've got this proud person that has got absolutely no regard for God. He's got all these plans. He's going to do this, he's going to do that. Why? That he might get gain. So it's all for himself. There's absolutely no regard of God. And then what happens? What's the next verse? You don't know what's going to happen. Can you actually, when you break it down to it, can you actually control what is going to happen? No. What's Matthew 6 verse 24 say? It says, "Take no thought for tomorrow." You don't actually know what is going to happen. So how can you go and plan all these years in advance? And he says there, "What is your life? It's but a vapor." And so if you think about that, it's, you know, the steam from a kettle, it's like a vapor, like it comes and then it goes. And essentially when you break it down, when you get past all your daily routines, that essentially is what your life is. Okay, so how can you go about planning all these things? You think you're going to be all this stuff, when at the end of the day you don't actually know what's going to happen to you tomorrow. And you think about the man who goes off and builds all the barns, and he's going to build these bigger barns, and what happens? He dies. And that's it. And that's his point. And so in verse 15, what we should actually be saying, he said, "For that ye ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that." God willing, yes. Now, without thinking of it as a cliche, all right, God willing, the amount that it's used, without thinking of it as a cliche, think of how powerful those words actually are when you look at this. I mean, these are the words of a humble person, aren't they? They're the words of a person that is of a single mind. And what is that mind? It's of God working in his life, isn't it? God willing, I'm going to do this. God willing, I'm going to do that. And if you think about it in your life, how often do you actually use these words? Without them becoming a cliche, yes, but actually thinking about the meaning behind these words. I mean, when you're going to plan something next week, I mean, yeah, okay, you're going to study week in 5 weeks' time. Well, that's God willing, isn't it? And so you can see the power of these words. And again, let's remember, it's the humble person that is going to use these words. And so again, in the context, this is a way that you can test your humility, is that how are you planning? Are you thinking of God? Is God in all of your plans? And so in verse 16, we have the proud man. He's in contrast, you've got the word but there. What is he doing? He's rejoicing in, he says, but now ye rejoice in your boastings. All such rejoicing is evil. Now, the only other occurrence of this word, and you need to write this down, is in 1 John 2 and verse 16, of boastings. And in 1 John 2 verse 16, it's rendered there as the pride of life. Now, how beautifully does that tie in? Because that's exactly what this person was. That was exactly his focus. It was the pride of life that was driving him. And so he says, therefore, but now you rejoice in your boastings. And that kind of rejoicing is evil. Right, so it's slightly past, but I'm just going to wrap up now. So if you think about all of this now, if you think about James chapter 4, if they were displaying the wisdom of God, it would have been a very different letter, wouldn't it? And if we now look at, if we now flick back over the page and we scan our eyes over, right? I remember we started off a bit with that question in verse 4, about being a friend of the world. Why were they a friend of the world? It's because they were showing the wisdom of the earth. They were showing those earthly sensual desires. If they had have been showing the wisdom of God, it would have been a very different letter. Because they wouldn't have been fighting with each other, would they? In verses 1 to 3. They wouldn't have been committing adultery with God. No longer would they have been a friend of the world. And there would have been no need for God to actually draw near to them, because they would have already been in a relationship with him. Humility, he wouldn't need to speak about humility, because humility would have been shown in their life. The way that they dealt with their friends, their brothers and sisters. And if they were a humble person, God would have been in their life plans. And so you can see there, if they were actually showing the wisdom of God, which is what all this is about, the wisdom of God versus the wisdom of man, it would have been a very different lesson. And so I guess we need to think about what wisdom we might be showing in our lives. And so he then concludes in verse 17, and he says, therefore, to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. So from what we've learnt tonight and knowing all that we do, what are we actually going to do?